Well, I would love to start with, looking back at Stone Reader documentary. You had a purpose. You were trying to search for this lost book. I'm curious, with It Was the Music, what was that initial search moment? Like, what made you go, I've got to tell Larry and Teresa's story. I've got to figure out more about this man. What was that spark?
Well, again, it was totally personal. It wasn't like in Stone Reader. The MacGuffin of the story is I'm looking for Dow, and it takes you through that like a sort of like a mock mystery in some ways. Although it would, you saw it as it happened. But what I was really interested in was what books mean to us and why. So while that's the narrative, the film is really about, shared imaginations and how we trade books or think about books and make friends through them and what it's meant to us. And I thought about that, not just about books, but about music, art, movies, TV, all kinds of things. I've thought about it my whole life, or almost my adult life. And so back in 2006, I guess Stone Reader had been out. I guess the DVD had been out a year, and there was still some action with it. I had started making another film where I was making that about art and a similar sort of narrative search about, an unknown artist. And I started making notes for a music film, and then I started filming some music stuff in 2006, and it's actually in the film, and I talk about it. They shut down an old radio station, college radio station called WXPN, where I worked at, and 75 to 80. I was out of college, but I was so interested in music, I was volunteering at the station and doing air shifts. And I said, I got to film. They're shutting this down. It's like, it's just, I got to film it, and I went in, and John DiLiberto, who's the host of a very popular syndicated show called Echoes, and I went in together because we both began, working at the radio station together. And I set it aside, but it got me thinking, and I started making notes. And when you watch It Was the Music, the opening scene talks about Colleen and I seeing Larry and Teresa play. I didn't know who Larry and Teresa were. It wasn't like I had to go out and find anything out about Larry and Teresa. But their music and their act crystallized for me that night when I saw them. A lot of things I held dear about music and what it's meant to me in my life. And I talked to Larry after the show, and I saw the whole film. I saw it instantly. And I said, somebody should make a film about you guys. And I had really wanted to make a film about a whole generation of us who grew up on a certain kind of music and what it meant to us and how we're still pulling the 20th century forward in the 21st to some extent. And he said, okay. I mean, it took a couple months to really make the deal work, but and I went out. But the short answer to your question is I didn't, like Stone Reader, I didn't know what I was getting into when I did it. I like the idea of picking up the camera and discovering it as you go. And in this case, you always think you know what you're doing. Oh, we're going to shoot Hot Tuna, Jack Cassie, and Yarma Kokin in here, and I'm going to get this interview with Roseanne Cash, who Larry used to, play with. And oh, now's a chance to go talk to Tracy Nelson, who I've always loved, who nobody knows where she is, and we can talk about, her experiences back in the 60s and 70s and link that back to Larry because, Roseanne loved those records, and Roseanne knows Larry and Teresa, and all these kind of linkages, right? And you make that, and you shoot it, and you really think you're onto something. And then if you're smart, you'll put the stuff aside for a while, right? You won't edit it right away. You sort of put it aside. And you look at it, and when you look at it, you see something else. You see what the film is really about, or what the material is. The material talks to you, It doesn't, it didn't necessarily fall neatly into the chapters you thought it was going to. But if you're experienced enough, you sort of look at it for what it is. In all those years I used to make political ads, you know, the trick was to work with what you had and make it speak and communicate, not try to force, you know, squares into round holes, right? So, and that's what's nice about doing it for yourself, too, Gotti. You can, you know, if you're doing it for HBO or you're doing it for, you know, a corporate entity, or, you know, you're sort of obligated to pull off what you agreed to do. In this case, you know, doing it for myself, I could just turn it to where it had to go.
I'm curious, when did you get the idea to give a camera to Larry and Teresa? And I know Teresa took hold of it, but I'm curious, when did you get that idea?
That's a great question. Early on, Teresa, Larry was sort of, I'll go with the flow, I trust you, I get it, okay? Teresa was, well, wait a second, what makes you think you know what you're doing or talking about? You know, I know some things, and I don't think you're going to quite understand what it is, you know, you're seeing here. And I thought she was wrong, and I could do that. We've worked in all kinds of cultures all over the world and done stuff. You don't have to be, you know, I don't have to be from Kenya to make a good film about Kenyans, which, you know, I'm working on. So it I think that is a mistaken thing. You know, we used to do politics all the time. We'd do a governor of Louisiana, and somebody would say, what do you know about Louisiana? And I said, well, you know, I know how people vote, and I know what they're after. You know, I don't, you know, and people are pretty much the same in human nature all over. So I sort of gave it to her to sort of appease her at first. I said, here, why don't you take the camera? If you come across something you think that I'm missing, shoot it, you know? I mean, shoot some stuff, and we'll see. And I especially wanted her to get some of the stuff on the road where I couldn't be there. Okay, so while checking into a hotel or getting off an airplane, you know, stuff that just was, you know, sort of travelogue and on the road stuff. Teresa has a master's in directing from the University of Tennessee. This is one super smart, accomplished, talented individual in multiple ways. And within a short amount of time, she had figured out how to use the camera and was coming back, you know, would download the footage every so often. And it just got better and better and better to the point where, you know, she was beginning to know exactly where to put the camera, put it here, walk into the room and do that. So a lot of the really cool stuff in that movie is Teresa shot. We used to call it, we have a whole, you know, on Avid, you know, we have these bins and files and we have a thing called Teresa Cam. That's what we'd call it, Teresa Cam. And I almost toyed with the idea of putting Teresa Cam on the screen during some of her shots. But but by the end, some of it was so integrated with how we were doing it that it just worked. I think it really... There's a scene where Larry gets frustrated in the studio and tosses his glasses across the room, and you're not going to see that from Larry. But Teresa will see it, you know? I don't know if we would have ever seen it if we were there. There's a great scene we cut where she takes the camera and walks into their hotel room, which is disheveled and stuff everywhere, you know, between gigs or whatever on the road. And you really get a sense of the intimacy of their marriage and what it's like to do this on the road. And she talks, she talks to the camera, she's doing it. It's just great, but it's so good almost, it's so intimate that nothing else matches up. So, you know, that's a scene we cut. We're not the first people to do that. Lots of people have given cameras to people in COVID time now. I think we're going to see a lot of things come out where filmmakers have shot stuff, but they've given cameras to people to do in their houses or record themselves. I think you're going to see some really cool stuff with that way.
As far as total footage, I mean, what were you going through? How much footage did you actually capture for this series?
I don't shoot a lot. I'm not somebody who shoots hundreds of hours of stuff. I've had people come to me, you know, as consultant to say, hey, I've got 250 hours here. What do you think I should do with it? You see almost everything I've shot, except you don't see all of the scenes. So there were a couple scenes that were deleted, a few I cut down, but you see it all. You don't see the 45 minutes talking with Buddy Miller, for instance. You end up seeing six or seven. But most of the stuff is there. So we shoot at a pretty low ratio. Stone Reader was shot, because it was shot on film, I shot it almost 6-1, and a lot of that was his interview cut. So the scenes and the B-roll and all that stuff is fairly, we use a lot of it, you know. So it's not like we're just out shooting randomly. And, you know, I sort of have a focus. This works, this matters, and that's what we go for.
I think the film does a wonderful job of capturing all of the great voices and people that Larry and Teresa have worked with, and there's obviously a lot of connecting points. One episode that I really loved, though, was episode 3 with blind boy Paxton, because I wasn't aware of him. Can you talk about, still, even though doing a film about music that's been around, you still find new voices, even in this series? I mean, I thought that was one of my favorite episodes. It's like, here's another voice, and there's, I think you find people along the way that maybe other people haven't connected with or don't know their music.
Me too. I felt the same way as you do, and being there was you know, doubly thrilling. And that happened, you know, several times, and it actually made me, one of the reasons that the thing goes at the length it does is because that was just so great, and you keep wanting that to happen over and over again. In fact, maybe we do a season 2. I always thought we could do a season 2. It would be about Blind Boy. Fantastically talented guy, and just a charismatic, incredibly great to be around. That came about. Teresa, there's a scene early on where you see Blind Boy playing harmonica at a music festival, and mm-hmm. Teresa shot that, and she sent it to me, and she said, you got to look at this guy, he's great, we've worked with him a couple times here and there, been on the same bills, and he's fantastic. So that was just sort of in my back pocket, and I looked at that, and got in touch with his manager, and started thinking about, you know, how can we hook up with the guy. Meanwhile, I talked to, you know, I'm talking with Jack Cassidy and Jorma Kalkinen, and Jorma brings up his name and says, there's this fantastic guy, Blind Boy Paxton, he's been to Fur Peace Ranch with us, and man, you got to check him out. And I say, yeah, I know who he is, you know. So we finally got together, and we met up in Brooklyn at his place, and he's just great. I mean, he just is. There's a scene, and this one I had to cut, but he has a homemade banjo, and he picked up the banjo and was playing it, we tried to shove that in, but it was enough to see him play the Unlucky Blues and, you know, get on piano. We did shoot him at a club. I didn't use it, he's great. I mean, he's just great. I have seen him perform at a blues festival, he knocks you out. He's just one of the best people you can go see live. But there's so much good live people these days. Well, not now because of COVID, but, you know, I mean, we might have made the last film, you know, of of small venues seeing people. You know, I don't know when that'll next happen. But I think it's because, you know, if you're in the music business and you're a performer, you know, you're not going to make any money selling records or on Spotify or whatever, so you've got to have a live act, and your act has to be great now. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of great acts, more than just people playing their songs. You know, when I was I was a teenager in the 60s and whatever, and when you went to see a live show, people played their song. There was very little stagemanship or whatever. David Bromberg could do it, you know, in the 70s, Bruce Springsteen learned, and eventually people got good again. But, you know, I remember, as much as I love Neil Young, and he's one of my favorites ever, you know, just leaving one of his concerts after 30 minutes. It was just, you know, he sat there, played songs, it was kind of boring, you know. You know, it was just like, what was it? Records were better.
Another real wonderful element of the show is certain episodes you go into one that pops into mind is Mort's TV in repair, and you get the you get the music player repaired, and then, you know, that is the catalyst for getting to listen to that music later on. But I'm curious, can you talk a bit about those types of moments in the show, finding nostalgia in going to places that, you know, like Mort's, that capture the vibe in the 60s? Because for me, I mean, I don't have a player. I mean, I listen to my music off my phone. It's a different world.
Now, how old are you?
I'm almost 40, so I'm not even that young compared, but I'm still a generation, right, you know, removed from you. Yeah.
One of my production partners, her name's Senna Wilkerson, and she's instrumental in making this film and did some great stuff on it. There's a scene in one of the record store shots where Teresa says to Senna, because Senna's off camera, she's shooting, says, she says something about, does anybody have a record player? And she says, Senna, don't you have a record player? And Senna says, yes, she does. But, she, you know, she's an old soul. But I think it's something I wanted to do. I wanted to, as we follow Larry and Teresa through the course of trying to be out on the road themselves in their own act together for the first time in their early 60s, stuff people do in their 20s, packing their car and driving from gig to gig. I mean, these are two extraordinarily successful musicians and performers who could play with anybody. I mean, Larry has constant calls. He can be out with Jackson Brown. He played with Bob Dylan for 8 years. You know, he can be a music director here. Teresa can do stage. She has constant requests for doing all kinds of things. They had enough of it, enough of being apart. They wanted to do this together. They wrote their own songs and went out on the road. And as much as the story follows them forward through that first year of being on the road and what it's like, and it's a story, I think, as much about relationships and couples and marriage and what we've gone through at this point in our lives, anybody from our generation, I wanted to drive the story back in a personal way to what music meant to me early on, and I hope by extrapolation to millions of people who hung out in record stores or had those old stereo components, like, you know, we see in Mort's repair shop, and all of us who began with that fold-down flip-top, you know, turntable with the attached speakers, and putting the vinyl on there, and waiting for the $279 record sale, and getting your record. And by the way, you only bought records back then that your friends didn't have. Nobody bought a record that your friend had. You went and listened to the record at their house, right? And as we got deeper into that, and you see in a number of times Larry and I connect about stuff, we all had the same sort of experiences with concerts and records back then, unlike now, because there wasn't that much Gotti coming out. I mean, it was, you know, it wasn't like the internet. There were three or four or five new releases every few weeks, you know, on the racks, or half a dozen from a record. It was, you knew every record there was. It wasn't like there was infinite amount of music. There were these amount of records put out by these labels in these record stores, and that was it, you know? That was it. So, yeah, I loved seeing that old record by Larry. He was thrilled when we prepared it. I did it sort of as a surprise, and when he got it back, he was thrilled, and I said, what are you going to do with this? He said, I'm going to listen to records all this weekend. I said, but, you know, he's got one of the greatest, you know, not only, you know, live and studio musicians, but record producers. I mean, Larry's a major producer, and he's going to listen to it on stuff on that. It's just, there's something, and I knew what he meant. I said, wow, that's, you know, the sound of those, anybody our age, the sound of that record dropping, right? We do it a couple of times when Larry's, you know, the sound of the record dropping onto the platter from the, you know what I mean?
I've got to ask, since you brought up your team, can you tell me how big of a team you worked with? How many folks were part of this production for you?
It's pretty large. I you know, filmmaking's collaborative, and this is the work of dozens of us, dozens. I like to work with other filmmakers, so, in other words, it's not just a DP or a sound man or you know, a lighting guy. mostly everybody I work with can do multiple jobs, so I can, you know, I can boom and hand the camera to somebody else if I want to. Somebody else can, you know, boom and grab this, and can, you know, we move around and everybody is equally good at it. For instance, Emily Topper, who shot a lot of the West Coast stuff, she also shot Ain't In It For Your Health, the film about Levon, and she shot the Jackson Brown interviews and Michael Simmons, and did that great scene with you know, the rest in peace Larry Taylor of Canned Heat. And I would shoot the other camera. You know, the two of us would shoot and would have a sound person, but it was small. We would normally be, and Colleen would help me and assist me, lenses and things. So three of us, four of us sometimes. Sometimes we had bigger shoots, would have, you know, some of the stage stuff. We might have four or five cameras, and you'd recruit people to, you know, give, you know, here's a free concert, I'll pay you a little bit, can you man this camera? But they'd be skilled people for the most part, right? That's it. So there were those of us in the field. There's a great there's a scene on the porch where we shoot Teresa singing with her parents, and it's in I think it's in episode 5. But it's a wonderful scene of how Teresa grew up singing with her family and why she's such a good singer, you know, these days, because it started so early. And that was just Cedric Akins, a sound guy, but also a filmmaker, came from Memphis, brought his camera, brought his lights, he did the sound, and I shot it, just the two of us. You know, sometimes less is more with this, you know? Like, you want to be, I think a lot of documentary filmmakers will tell you that. If you have the chops and you can keep it small enough, you can move faster and get more. But Cedric did an amazing job on that to record. Look, he's recording three guitars, four singers, fighting my frame, and fighting traffic and birds to get that. And it's beautifully sound mixed on location by him. And just, you know, one of the stellar moments of the whole series, I think. On the cutting side, in post, you know, I usually do a sort of a rough out, and then I bring in an editor, and this time it was Kathy Soler, who also cut Stone Reader with me. I brought her out of retirement. She came kicking and screaming, but she did it. and then two or three other people who were working with me and part of the team as editors, Senna one of them, John Papalardo. And then I go through several teams of what you might call consulting editors. So once I think I have something, I bring in somebody else who hasn't seen anything, right? Hasn't worked on it for 3 months or a year, and is able to say, wait a second, I'm completely lost here, who is that? You know, and that helps a lot, because at some point you don't have perspective anymore, you know.
Can we talk about,
let me add one more person.
Oh, there's, yeah,
a guy named John Bowen who mixed this, and he worked on it, I would say, as much as any editor. The mix on this was, we took a lot of shortcuts with the sound, and not just the production sound, but some of this music. But I knew John would be there, and he's a fantastic post-production mixer, and he, what he did with this was not to be believed, and it really is, for a musical documentary, it sounds great, and he gets all the credit for that.
Can you talk about, you mentioned the porch. There's so many moments we have in places we don't necessarily ever get to see talent like this. I mean, the behind-the-scenes stuff, the at-home stuff. I mean, getting to see their home, getting to see Larry and the production side of things. Just access-wise, how much fun was this in the fact that you guys really got to go wherever you wanted to go, it feels like, and because of that, we get to see that.
We had complete access to people who cooperated and wanted to give us access, you know. But Larry and Teresa never said no. They didn't say no once to anything. It was just a matter of us being there, finding the time, and doing it. But I wanted to. Here's the thing: when you watch music on film, it's a really, you know, it's not done great a lot of the times. Like, Stop Making Sense is unbelievable, okay? The Last Waltz is as good as music's ever been put down on film. And you know, and there's other instances of that. I wasn't going to compete with that. But what I was interested was what I was interested in the distinction between the recorded music I grew up with and how inspiring all those records were, and how, as a grown-up, it's live music that was really touching me now. And I wanted to get as much live music in as we could, but not necessarily stage music, right? I wanted to, you know, so Blind Boy picks up his guitar and sits in his chair and plays. Larry and Teresa come out on the porch and play. Jerry Douglas practices a Tom Waits song with him in a dressing room. I mean, some of these things are filmed marginally and recorded marginally, you know, but they're real, and the enthusiasm of the people playing backstage or just singing or playing, and the love for the music that these musicians have is, I wanted to get that across, because that's what I felt in the audience seeing a lot of these acts and felt connected to it and realized it's real, you know? As Yorma says in the film, it's not that all like to have a gazillion selling record, but it's honest music. It's like, you know, it's what they're doing, and they're lucky to make a living out of it, although being on the road is not easy.
Not only do we get to meet all these wonderful people, I feel like I got to know you a little bit, and I'm curious, there are elements where you open up about your life in this, very small snippets. I mean, just the end of the series with you putting the CD in that your daughter made for you. Can you talk a bit about putting a film or a series out there that also opens up just a little bit of yourself? Is that scary? Is that fun?
I think it's necessary. I do it because I feel it's necessary for, if I'm going to tell you this story, you've got to know a little bit of who I am and whether you want to trust me or not. And I felt the same way in Stone Reader, which is why I did that film that way. There's wonderful documentaries made all the time by people who are just, you know, they're not in them. But they're expressing a viewpoint, and sometimes you can sense it. You know, Barbara Kopple, for one, who is not in her films, but you strongly feel her voice and who she is in the making of it and what she takes on. Mm-hmm. I think the same thing is with Earl Morris, who's in some of them in bits and pieces, and there's a voiceover, off-camera questions. But for me, while I'm not the protagonist in this so much, it's, you know, while as I am in Stone Reader, I just felt I couldn't, you know, I there were cuts I made where I was in it much less, and they work. In fact, I do have a cut where I'm not in it at all, and it's really an interesting cut. And it still works because, as I said, it's sort of my view, and you still feel it. But, those little revealing things all sort of add up and right from the beginning of why I, you know, the beginning of I think the quickest and easiest way for me to tell you without any artifice of how much this meant to me and why I'm making the film was just to say it and show it, you know? And I had a lot to... As the older you get, Gotti, the more you feel you have to say. And I felt I had a lot to say about this. The trick of filmmaking is, how much can you get other people to say it for you, right? So stuff Jack Cassidy says, or Tracy Nelson says, or Jerry Douglas or Larry along the way is great. And every time they'd say something that I felt people should know about, I'd check that off the box. But by the end of it, there were things that nobody said, and so it's a way for me to say them.
You mentioned earlier you've been working on other projects. I know you've got the art one, and you mentioned the one in Kenya, about the runners. Do you work on all your projects? You know, obviously you're working on them at the same time, but how do you change hats, do you feel like, or does it all work out the same? I mean, I'm curious, you work on so much.
No, I can tell you, that question was asked, when I made Stone Reader, I went to a lot of, you know, writer forums and heard a lot of people talk, and Ron Carlson, who's a really, really great, great short story writer, who's written some good novels too, and Actually, was one of the few people out there who had read The Stones of Summer well before we made the film. Ron was asked that, and he said, and this really sunk in my head, even though he's coming from a writer, he said, he works on his short stories, right? And if he can't finish it, if he's stuck, he sets it aside, and he starts a new one, all right? It doesn't mean that other one's dead. Sometimes he comes back to it, sometimes he doesn't. But that's how I work on these films. Like Ron teaches at the University of Arizona State, I think, still, or I don't know if he still does. I have a day job. I mean, I make a lot of pay-for-hire work. I'm hired as a sort of a hired gun director to either work on other people's projects or commercials or all kinds of things. So that's an ongoing business, and it sort of pays the freight. And meanwhile, there's these things that I want to go make and do, like a developer, I'm like a builder. So, you know, a builder, I'm building houses and building fancy things for some people, but every once in a while I buy a piece of land and speculate and put my own thing down. And I have multiple unfinished things. I mean, this film here was a part of a sort of unfinished thing from 2006 that I finally, as Ron Carlson and Tagpie, pulled the story back out, and now I knew how to finish it. So seeing Larry and Teresa, I suddenly said, I know how to finish this story now, right? So there's a number of things. The Kenya film is about teenagers from the slums of Kabir. We were the first people to shoot in Kabir for many years, a few years ago. There's been a couple crews there since. It's the slums of Nairobi, a million people. And we filmed a former Olympic, long distance runner from Kenya who is helping teenagers get out of the slums by taking them up in the hills and training them to run long distance and run, you know, compete. And in Kenya, you can make a living at that. There's 5,000 running clubs equivalent to, you know, like baseball. So, like, you know, somebody, it's like getting somebody out of the projects and getting them to, you know, college or, you know, seeing a bigger thing in life. So he has a charitable organization that does that. And the story came to me through a producer. It's her story, and she asked me if I'd, you know, film it for her, and I agreed. It's been a fantastic experience, and I hope we can finish it soon. There's another film that's sitting around called Art Stops Here. I started shooting it actually before Stone Reader was finished. This probably started shooting that in 2001, so I'm going to finish that. That'll be out next year. I'm almost done, and it has a 20-year run to it, and it's a fantastic story about things we hold dear based around a art collector who buys 535 paintings from a dead artist's estate valued at nothing and decides to make it his life's work to make this artist known again. Kind of like what I did with Stones of Summer for you know, Stone Reader, but he's the one pushing the ball up the hill this time that I follow him. And then there's films I've made, and I just haven't done anything with them. Like some writers will, you know, write a novel and put it in the drawer. I made a film on 24 breast cancer survivors, part of a Dragon rowboat rowing team once. It was heartbreakingly, it was a fantastic film. Some of the people died before the film was finished, and it was heartbreaking to have that happen, and I never found sort of a way around that. And technology changed, and I lost some of the files, and I just sort of put it away, although everybody who saw parts of it yells at me all the time, why don't I finish that? It's fantastic, even though it's old now, it's still meaningful. But, you know, I think, you know, we've gotten to the point, as for any young, especially younger filmmakers out there, that you can start shooting stuff and get, you know, it'll cost you a little bit of money, and you can't look at it as a waste. You know, you look at it as sort of a learning experience, and it all has some value at some point. But you can start making films like people like Ron Carlson, which start short stories, you know, and put it away until maybe the time comes where you rethink it or redo it. I mean, that's the great thing about documentary work as opposed to feature work, is that you don't have to find the same actors or actresses. You don't have to find the same locations. You know, you can pick up and let go of these stories, you know, at your will.
Well, I guess to kind of wrap things up, Mark, I would love to know, I ask this of most documentary filmmakers especially, but Is there something you've read, watched, an art show you've been to recently that caught your eye? Just something that inspired you on your own personal journey? It can be over the years, it can be recent, whatever you want to share. Yeah.
Since we're on music and since the film is about what that means to us, and as I say at the beginning of it, for all these years I thought it was, the books that had sort of formed me, and then at some point I realized maybe it was the music. Last night, and, we're sort of, the film is out there now, and it's sort of, it's being marketed, but there's no changes to make, and it is what it is, and it'll, be this way for a long time. I put on a couple John Coltrane records, vinyl.
Mm.
And these are records that I had since I was in high school and college, and I remember the incredible excitement about buying a John Coltrane record and deciding which one, and living with that record for months at a time. Okay, for months at a time, knowing every note of every solo, knowing McCoy Tyner's downbeats, knowing the whole thing. And over the last 20 or 25 years, since CDs and things, I've not listened to the vinyl that much and not listened to those. In the course of making It Was the Music, I learned that Larry's best friend growing up, who he, learned to play guitar with, had his first band with, and it's in the film. It was a guy named Bob Thiel Jr. His father was Bob Thiel, the record producer who produced the Coltrane records, or the ones on Impulse, at least, for years, and, some of them, and as well as B.B. King and, dozens of other amazing, musicians. So it was like full circle to come around and put those Bob Thiel-produced Coltrane records on last night and feel... there was 8 inches of snow here, not in Dallas, but in the East Coast, there was a lot of snow yesterday. You're locked in. I had shoveled. I put those records on. I bet this one record, the blue cover, I bet I haven't listened to that in 25 years, okay? Maybe more. And, man, to hear it and feel those notes again and feel it, it was like closure, God. It was like... it's a lot of it began there, and it just felt good that it had the same power now. When you read a book, and I've read, I'm at the age now where I reread books, and they're different to me. The book hasn't changed, but I've changed. And I felt that way about that Coltrane record before, when I used to know every soul, and man, this is hot, this is sizzling and out there. Now it was like very settling and almost, inside me. It wasn't like, I didn't hear the excited, raving Coltrane. I heard sort of the inner Coltrane, and that was, I hope I can keep that feeling with me for at least a week, if not a day or a year, but a week would be nice.
Wow. Mark, thank you for sharing that, and it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for putting out It Was the Music. It was a pleasure watching that, and I can't wait to see... not only your art film, but this the slums of Nairobi. I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, I think the art film will be the best of this trio, perhaps. In some ways, it's going to sum up the things. It'll have a little bit of Stone Reader. It actually begins with Dal Mossman, age 75, riding his motorcycle, and it's going to have a little bit of Teresa in it, and a lot of other things, scraps and pieces. But I think it'll be a summary of these. Like a trio, right? We'll have done reading, we'll have done music, and we'll do, art. And the Kenya film is something different. I'm not in that one, but it's, I do a lot of these things where I am just the guy behind the camera, and that's a really safe place to be, Gotti. I like it there, but, you can't always play it safe.
Well, Mark, I hope to catch up when all that comes out, and I think we need to start a band called Inner Coltrane. I think that'd be the next step.
Yeah.